Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck Knicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. Today on the show, I talked to Kenya Barris. He's the creator of Black-ish and the writer of Girls Trip as well. And he's also got this new comedy series on Netflix called Black AF. As fuck, right? Right? See, I know how to... I'm not great with those. I am not good. I always have to look up the... what do you call those when it's just letters? Someone gave me a... O-D-A-T. I didn't know what that was. One day at a time. Had to look it up. Didn't know if it was something dirty or not. Okay, so I'll talk to Kenya Barris in a minute or two. It's going to be tricky. It's going to be tricky, folks. My brother left yesterday, and I'm going solo, and I guess this is the time I go solo. This is what happens. I guess it'll be 2 weeks tomorrow, and now I'm by myself, and I'm in lockdown. I'm quarantined. You know, it's weird because I'm mad because someone I love died, but I've been around long enough to know that I've seen many people I know die for one reason or another, sometimes for no reason at all. It's always fucking horrible. And I just don't know what's going to happen. I really don't know what's going to happen in my mind. I mean, I'm getting out. I'm getting onto the mountain. I'm getting out into the air. I'm getting hiking. I'm talking to people all the time. I got a headache right now. I'm having a hard time breathing because I'm holding in my fucking feelings most of the time or stuffing. I don't even know if I'm stuffing them. It's just like, the fuck am I supposed to do? I guess I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. But I'm afraid, you know, it's this one day at a time shit, this 1 minute at a time shit. But I tell you, man, I am amazed at people just being human, just people, just old school shit. People are sending cards, like old school cards in the mail, condolence cards. My neighbors, who I don't really know that well, have come over. Guy across the street came over a few days ago. He'd cooked some chicken. He offered me some chicken. And flowers are coming. Foods is coming still. Ice cream came. Emails, texts. But just people showing up. I'm scared of my mind. I got to figure out a way. I will figure out a way. I don't want to be a downer, man. I don't want to bring everyone down. I'm still way in the fucking woods. And why wouldn't I be? I'm just trying to frame the thoughts into good things. I'm trying to feel the feelings. But holy fuck, you guys. Jesus Christ. Woo. Now I just got to look at fucking Monkey. I was prepared for Monkey to die. I was not prepared for my girlfriend to die. I've been preparing for Monkey to fucking die for months. But now, like, if he dies, I mean, Jesus Christ. That'll just be like, all right, there. Well, there you go. Thank God the grief portal is open. I'll just toss him through it, too. Fuck. But I'll be honest with you, the concern I share with the people I talk to on the phone is just that, like, I'm worried about, you know, where my brain goes. And, you know, the advice I've gotten is, you know, stay in touch with people, do what you got to do to take care of yourself. You know, because it doesn't take much for me to get bleak and wonder, you know, what it's all worth, you know? I will try to embrace whatever the hell Lynn saw in me and what you people seem to see in me. God damn it, I hope I get funny again. I've been kind of funny, I guess, on the phone, just trying to stay sane. I watched The In-Laws the other night again with my brother. Been cooking. You know, it's going to be a long haul, and I'm going to have to hang on. And I hope I'm not draining you guys. And I hope everybody who's going through grief is well supported, as I am. I guess we're all kind of traumatized. But yeah, I'm in touch with people. And it's weird. I don't think about drinking. I don't think about using drugs. I think a little bit about nicotine, you know, food. Yeah, you know, the onanism. When does that start? When do I start jerking off like a monkey to feel better? Huh? When does that happen? It's happening right now. I'm sorry, but you guys, you should know what I'm doing, right? God damn you guys. My heart is busted wide open. Motherfucker. Whew. Kenya Barris is on the show today. He's got a new comedy series, Black AF, Black As Fuck, is now streaming on Netflix. We did it over the video before the sadness. And it was pretty good. You know, I never know when people know anything about me or give a shit. But I'm learning, man. So this is me and Kenya Barris coming right up. Just give me a sec. All right, give me a sec.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
So, dude, nice to meet you.
You too, man. Such a huge fan.
Oh, that's nice of you.
Your Patrice O'Neill is like a class could be taught on it. I'm writing a movie, and it reminds me that Patrice was going to be, I think, that next level of comic. You know what I'm saying? I think that he was already there for he was a comics comic. You know what I'm saying? He was already there.
Yeah.
But he was going to be like, you know, honestly, I've been looking at the Jordan doc, which I'm in love with. Like, they could just pump it into my arm.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan, you could look at his rookie year, the way he played, and put that game into the NBA right now. It'd be the best game in the NBA. Like, the game has not progressed past where he was at. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right. Yeah, yeah.
Derivative. And so, I mean, even though LeBron's amazing and Kobe's amazing, the way Michael Jordan played the game has not been played better than that. Richard Pryor, to me, the way Richard Pryor, what he did, it's been derivative. Comedy's been derivative in some aspects since then. You know what I'm saying?
I think that's true. Yeah.
And I kind of feel like the first, that new voice that was starting to feel different for me, honestly, Patrice was as his powers were going to grow, I think that his voice was going to be, I mean, I'm sorry, bigger than Chappelle, and Chappelle's my God, you know what I'm saying? He's my friend, but he's also like a God, you know, bigger than Chappelle, bigger than Seinfeld, bigger than, you know, I think that Patrice O'Neill's voice was that. And your Marin, like, he said something that I have quoted and put in so many different ways. It's so, but like little things he said, the way he thought, you know what I'm saying? He was,
yes.
You know, he was an autodidact. He wasn't somebody who fucking, you know, was super, you know, formally educated, but he was brilliant. He talked about, and it sticks out to me, he talked about the notion that as horrible as the Holocaust was, right? And it was a horrible thing, but there was a face, know what I'm saying? He was like, you know, if you're a Nazi, we're coming, you know, knocking your door and pull you out your house at 100 years old. You know what I'm saying? There's a face that you can put to that evil. And right. He was like, you know, our face is just white. You know what I'm saying? We don't really have, you know, and it, that conceit has informed so many conversations and so much of what I did. Like the notion that there's never been a prosecutable case of slavery.
Right.
Saying, the greatest human atrocity, you cannot argue it. I mean, unless you go back to biblical times, which we don't really know, but the greatest human of record in record our recorded times, you know what I'm saying? One of the greatest human atrocities ever. And there's never been a prosecutable case. It's not illegal. You know what I'm saying? And there's never been a true apology. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Clinton is like a bullshit version of it. There's never been a true apology. So the notion that you take this people for 400 years and then say, you know, after a certain time, all right, nigga, it's over. You know what I'm saying? Go be free. And now expect them to just live in that same society and not be fucked up. You know what I'm saying? Is really, really, really interesting. And like, and not really give a face other than, you know what I'm saying?
And then this is the country that it happened in. And their relatives live around you.
Yes.
The generations of from the people that did that are down the street.
Down the street.
Like the Nazis, they all crawled away. They were busted. They were war crimes. Yeah. It was fucking horrible, but they were Germans. But this is sort of like, that was the old way of commerce. And now we don't need you, but enjoy.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So it just.
That's crazy.
I think it's interesting. And, you know, you guys, you and Patrice touched on stuff like that. But I feel like it's just, it's an interesting sort of like that informs and not to sort of harp, you know what I'm saying? Like I've. In the show I did it for Netflix, every episode was kind of because of slavery and then like something after it. Because I do really, in my heart, you know what I'm saying, and it goes back to that thing that you guys were talking, you and Patrice were talking about. They say it takes 2 to 3 generations for something to normalize, right? So like for us, I think a generation is 12 years, right? 12 or 15 years.
Uh-huh.
So the notion that for us to see two guys kissing, took about 2 generations, you know what I'm saying? Us to not be like, whoa, you know, call the police. Like for us to sort of be like, you know, it's a little bit more normalized than it was 30 years ago. You know what I'm saying?
It's, oh, sure. Yeah. You got, you know, it's like, you sort of adapt to it's about tolerance.
Right.
Really.
So 400 years, if 30 years takes, what does it take for a community to forget 400 years of something? You know what I'm saying? Like we were in, that was 40 generations or 35 generations. You know what I'm saying? If it takes, so the idea of that is, it's just amazing. And it informs a lot of, I think when I see, you know, people in my community doing certain things that I'm like, oh, please don't do that. I'm like, I then think back, well, they're doing pretty good considering.
Like what? What's an example?
I don't know. Like when I see, you know, rimmed out car bumping, you know what I'm saying, in a low-income neighborhood in the middle of the day. You know, I'm like, oh, because I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, with this, the perception we're putting out there. But then I really quickly want to explain to people, that's okay. You know what I'm saying? Like the idea of like the societal norms that might sort of be brushing up against, there are things and reasons why that's happening that from a social level, if we actually did some digging in, there are reasons that is actually a really big step forward for us. And I'm not looking for, you know, excuses or things like that. But I feel like you take a group and you fucking do the most heinous of things to them for 400 years and then put them, let them loose into that same group with the same people who did it. And in less than 100, you know, in 100 years, they are the president of that country. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'll take that. I'll take those batting averages and say that the, you know, there's some things that societally we might want to catch up on, or people might want to catch up with us. So we're not going to completely ride the normality wave.
Yeah. I just watched a movie. I got to interview Jeffrey Wright this week, and I watched a new movie that's on Netflix.
The story about Oakland.
And you know, one of the through lines of that was that as slaves, we were taught to survive, but not to
thrive.
Live, to thrive. Yeah. And like I don't know what that life is like, but I don't know that I ever heard it sort of framed like that. And it's a pretty powerful, disturbing movie.
Yeah.
when I see that stuff, I feel bad just because, you know, my life is small. I live in a house with a couple of cats. I go do stand up and I talk to people, you know. I don't, you know, black or white, it's still right. small. And I don't, whenever I see stuff like that, that depicts that kind of life, I'm like, you know, what the fucking world am I living in?
Right.
So when I see your show, the Black as Fuck show, and I see that, you know, your character struggling with, you know, with racial identity at the level that you operate mm-hmm. at, that's a whole other thing that, you know, that's a little closer yeah. to me. Like, I can relate to the criticisms you have of white people in that and your relationship with the mm-hmm. Jewish kid, you know, more than I can understand what the fuck
well,
is going
well,
on.
Well, I think that's interesting because I, you know, my friend, she has this saying that she says, she's like, God, like we walk a movie. She's like, black people only get to tell four stories. You know what I'm saying? And she was like, white people get so many stories. Like, we walked out of like Unorthodox. We were like, what a beautiful movie. You know what I'm saying? What a beautiful niche specialized movie, you know? And like, I feel like as much as I have heard great things about, and I love those kind of movies, and I'm sure I'm going to love Jeffrey's movie, I do feel like we get, you know, that in Boys in the Hood and Men in Society. And then we get, you know, a slave biopic, you know what I'm saying? And then we get, you know, I'm black and single and I can't find a man. And then we might get some sort of, you know, historical document, you know, some sort of historical movie.
No,
but
yeah,
I feel like I want to get a 1917, you know what I'm saying? I want to get a, you know, an unorthodox, a Punch Drunk Love, you know what I'm saying? I feel like we have some other things to talk about.
Of course. Yeah. And also oddly that, you know, culturally, the whole culture was driven by stories and you only get these four in the world of commerce.
Yes, that's exactly right. In the world of commerce. So that was when we did Black AF. I really wanted to. One, I just really wanted to do something personal.
And you're so funny, man. You never did any comedy?
No, man. I mean, I wrote comedy. I'm not an actor at all. And I would never act in anything else other than that particular role.
But you never did stand-up?
I tried stand-up when I was in college. You know what I'm saying? A handful of times. Yeah, I did a handful of times. And I was actually decent. That's how I got into writing. You know what I'm saying? But I knew that I did not have the gift of presentation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I did the jokes. But I could not. Chris Tucker came in. I was in Atlanta going to school, and Chris Tucker came in and he bumped all the like open micers, right? Of course, because he's working out. And for an hour and a half, he got up and talked about nothing. And I was like, I will never be able to do that.
Right? Was it like at the Punchline?
It was Earthquakes Comedy, Uptown Comedy Corner, I think it was called.
Oh yeah, Earthquake. I want to interview Earthquake. But getting back to what you're saying, I forgot to bring it up about Patrice. Like that interview to me. Like the people that lock into that thing, it's like it's almost like some sort of, you know, like a Bible. It's like there are certain people that register exactly because I knew him from around and, you know, he always busted my balls, but that meant he loved you. And, you know, I always respected him. But, you know, we kind of tucked away up there at Sirius, you know, in a side studio. We were both on other shows or we were guesting and he just happened to be up there and we just locked in. And I think what you're talking about is he had a fully formed philosophy of life that he pulled out of the sky. That, you know, like it's based on whatever wisdom he got from whoever he got it. But it was definitely this fully formed kind of point of view and philosophy that involved animals. It involved men and women.
The thing that he did that I really respected, that I really feel like, you know, I think that Dave is in, you know, is the greatest thing living. And I think that, like, you know, they would be Michael Jordan and, you know, and LeBron James in terms of, you know, who they are, or whatever. But I think the thing that I got from Patrice is he was able to form those things that you're talking about, which and do something that I think is the hardest to do, give context to his thoughts.
Right. He took the time to do it. And also, I think intellectually, they were harder to sell than what Dave does usually. And also, I think that Patrice honestly gave zero fucks and that, you know, his deep contempt for I don't think it's specifically just white people, but just the way the system worked, you know, he really wanted to tear shit down. Whereas I think Dave is a little more diplomatic.
And Dave in a different way. Dave, I don't think has about three fucks left to give. You know what I'm saying? Whereas Patrice had zero. Yeah. I think Dave is also an academic, you know what I'm saying? And Dave, you know, understands and looks behind things and gets, you know, I think that Patrice was a little bit more, excuse my thing, he was a little bit more of like a, you know, in my community, I'd be like, Patrice was a little bit more of a nigga, you know what I'm saying? Like, definitely nigga, but not like, Patrice was like, yeah. You know, I think it's he was different, you know what I'm saying? Patrice was two houses away from pimping. If it,
yeah,
if
that's right.
All,
yeah,
if it
yeah.
all went to shit, he had another plan, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we got a comic, do you know Keith Robinson?
Yeah.
He was actually a failed pimp. Those are the best stories.
I love the day when you have to give up on pimping and you're just like, it's just not for me. I'm not good.
He just didn't have the he was too sensitive. He couldn't.
That is a fucking fantastic. My last day of pimping, like the day you give up pimping, like.
there's a funny story. Talk to Keith. And why you gave it up.
Like, what was that last reason? What was the thing that he was just like, you know what?
I've had it. I've had it with you. You're all on your own.
For me.
So, you went to, where'd you grow? You didn't grow up in Atlanta, though.
No. I grew up in between Inglewood and Pacoima. It's a little, like, Pacoima's a little hood in the valley, and Inglewood's a little suburban hood in South Los Angeles.
Yeah, and that your family's there? They came from there?
No, my dad came from Omaha, Nebraska, and moved out here. And my mom, New York via parents in West Indies, New York, and then grew up in Santa Barbara.
Huh. That's a bit how they meet.
My mom was like one of the only black girls in Santa Barbara, and her other black girlfriend wanted to meet real black guys. So they would sneak out the house and drive to L.A. My dad was like a hood dude from East L.A., and he was like, you know, a year or two older than my mom. He was like in the streets. My mom loved it. And she'd go out and get, you know, in trouble with my dad and then drive back to Santa Barbara. And then she got pregnant at 16 for my dad. And my mom, my grandmother put her, you know, told her she had to go live her life. And she had my sister at 17.
Oh, wow. And your dad was like, he was like from Nebraska?
He was from, you know, but he grew up like in the same neighborhood as Malcolm X. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, he's like, that's Malcolm X from Omaha, Nebraska, too. He grew up in the same neighborhood as Malcolm X. He would see Malcolm X was older than him, but he called him Big Red. He would see him in the, you know, he was older than him when he was young. It's a lot of transplants, actually, from there. You know what I'm saying? That place is very sort of has an interesting history in itself.
The Nebraska history, black history of Nebraska?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I have, you know, my dad just passed a couple months ago, but he used to try to have a family reunion, and you would hear, you know, knowing Malcolm X comes from like a really, it has a lot of like layered things to it. And you know, those two people coming together, my dad was a part of the Nation of Islam. You know, he's a Muslim. My mom grew up Jehovah's Witness. So like those two people raising me, like I had no holidays, nothing but fucking church clothes.
Well, there's definitely a certain amount of discipline on both sides of that.
Yes. Yes. My dad was like a bad Muslim because he's supposed to sell these papers all the time. And instead, he would just buy them and put them in the garage and act like he sold them because he didn't want to go out and do it. But he wouldn't eat pork. And he would tell my mom, like, if she's going to cook pork, she had to have a whole separate set of pots for my dad's food. So it was a very interesting sort of, you know.
It's like being a Jew, being an Orthodox Jew.
Yes. It's a
mess. With the kosher.
Yeah.
You know? And so you grew up like just living in Los Angeles at that time.
Yeah.
And what was it? You know, you have one sister?
I have one sister and three brothers, yeah.
Three brothers. Older?
Well, one of them passed. He's my little brother, and two older.
What was, how did you end up, you know, being compelled to sort of pursue a life in comedy or show business? Or, like, did you, back then, I'm trying to figure out, I don't know what was going on when you were growing up. Did you go to comedy shows? Did you engage in shit like that?
I was comedy, like, Saturday Night Live was my babysitter. I got a hold of, my dad used to call them party records. I got a hold of like
the Red Fox
records. I got a hold of like those early Richard Pryor records. You know what I'm saying?
Craps record, the Blacksmith record.
Yeah. When he was talking about, you know, he told his woman he was, you know, fucking her friend and she got mad because she was fucking her too. You know what I'm saying? Just like things like and I started like realizing like irony and, you know what I'm saying? I would sort of like, those records kind of would like, you know, my family, my dad was abusive, you know what I'm saying? And
was he?
Yeah, he was abusive. And my mom, just a really strong lady, but like, you know, had a lot of kids, kind of put up with it. they were.
He beat you up, all the kids?
No, he was, you know, I was so young. My older brothers and sisters kind of got like, you know, some shoving things here. It was really taken out on my mom. You know what I'm saying?
Oh.
My dad was a good guy, but he, you know, had some dark days. And I think he owned later on in his life, you know, in a lot of ways, but you know, my mom and he had interesting, like he loved my mom, but like in that scary kind of love way, it's like, you know, like, and he convinced my mom, he had broke up one time or separated one time. And he convinced my mom to like, could you just have a talk with me? And he's like, I've really gotten into church. You know what I'm saying? He's like, and he was like saying he went away from, you know, Islam. And he's like, really got into church. My mom was like, and he showed her a Bible and she got in the car with him. And he was like, you drive. And she was like, what? And he had cut out the pages of the Bible and had a gun in it. And like literally made her drive around. And like, he convinced her, you know what I'm saying, to take him back. But like little stories like that I would hear.
Romantic stories.
Romantic, sweet things. But like my brother, who, you know, is to this day one of my heroes, funniest dude ever. Like when you come out of stuff like that, you look for things to sort of like take you out of it. And comedy was a big, big, big version of that. And those albums, I remember the Button Down Mine for me that, you know, Bob Newhart, you know what I'm saying, was just like, I started liking things that were smart. You know what I'm saying? I really felt like I liked things that were smart, that felt like there was a voice to them. You know, like you could tell a Newhart joke. You could tell a Pryor joke. You could tell.
Right.
And I started liking that really early on. And so I knew I wanted to do something with a voice. I didn't think I knew it was a voice, but I knew I wanted people to be able to hear what I had to say.
Well, I think you had the same reaction I did to stand up being, you know, I didn't grow up in an abusive environment, but I was definitely, it was an emotionally kind of draining environment. But I always felt that, you know, you watch a comic or you listen to a comic, there's part of you that thinks that like, they've got it. They understand shit. You know, you know what I mean? Yeah. They've got it wrapped up.
Yeah.
You know, because they could say things in a certain way and just blow your mind and make you look at things entirely differently and feel better.
Yeah. I feel like that's, you know, it's even in listen to your stuff, like the idea of being comedy's under attack right now. And it really scares me because comics are not just my heroes. They're important for the matriculation and the maturation of society.
You know, yeah, of democracy. They're a good lubricant.
Yes, and what they do is they are the people who take society in and they take it through their filter and metabolize it. And what they put back out, they put something back out in a palatable enough way that makes us think and provokes thought that subsequently can change society.
Yeah, what's your fear like right now around?
Is that the voices, it's so hard to have, like you have, you know, you need the 10,000 hours. You know what I'm saying, to put in before you can really actually, like you look at Pryor and he was, you know, trying to find himself for a long time. You know what I'm saying? You look at most comics and you're like, look at their early stuff. You know, they're trying to find stuff. Dave actually seemed like he found himself really early. But
I remember him when he was a kid. I was in New York when he came, when he showed up and when he was a teenager.
And it was solid. And right?
He definitely loved being on stage. And you know what I mean? And he loved that's the other thing between him and Patrice is like, I think Dave, you know, he really is charming and he really loves to be loved up there, you know?
He loves what he does.
Yeah. But like I could see in the last special, cause I was watching him, you know, watching how he was working stuff, is that he did this thing where he'd say something that he knew would be provocative and he would kind of like laugh at himself and then run into the back. He did it several times. Like it was almost sort of like, you know, I'm going to do this, but you know, I know it's going to be weird. And then I'm going to I'm going to buffer it. Whereas, you know, Patrice really wanted to blow brains out, you know, but the point was that Dave early on, he was fully, you know, he did this thing with the hat. He did that, he did this character thing. The difference between the ghetto dude and the guy, it was just a matter of him putting the bill of the hat. He did two characters by moving the bill of the hat. And it was great, man. I remember when I sat him down, it was funny because I haven't been able to talk to him on this show.
Oh, wow.
He won't do it. You know, I think he's pretty private around some things and I don't know, you know, But I remember, like, he was smoking a lot of weed and he was getting fucked up, and I saw it, and, you know, and I was, you know, I was fucked up, but I was trying to get sober and shit. I remember I sat him down and I just gave him this big lecture about not getting fucked up and throwing away his life on drugs and being one of those comics. And I brought it up to him years later. I said, "Do you remember when I did that? I talked, because I was fucked up when I was talking." And I said to him, "Do you remember when I did that?" He goes, "Yeah, man, I went home and read the Bible."
But, you know, it's interesting because I, in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years of my life, you know, 7 years, maybe, my life has just totally changed. I was a working writer, you know what I'm saying, who sold pilots, you know, and made a good career, made a good living. Blackish happened, and all of a sudden it just went, you know, it kind of took off in terms of things like that. And so I started, like, meeting my heroes, you know what I'm saying? And then beyond meeting my heroes, actually knowing my heroes, you know, getting to know my heroes. And it was, you know, we're like, Dave was one of my heroes, you know, and Dave was, I would sort of like, okay, be cool. You're in the same place with him. Just be cool, man. Just act like a normal person. It's no, hey, what's up, Dave? What's going on, bro? Like, act normal. Like, you know, it's hard, but over the years has become so sort of like, it's hard to not be normal around him because he's just so cool. And I had, like, the biggest sort of like mind blowing moment. I went to Toronto for the Laugh Festival a couple years ago. They were giving me some award or whatever. And Dave did a concert. I mean, him and a stool, right? And it was him and John Mayer was, like, backing up, and he let me come on stage with him and Wanda. And I sat at a table, and it was 27 or 30,000 people in a round, and just Dave and I was, Wanda and I were back on a stool on the stage, and I got to see him like a guy who knew how to fucking work a yo-yo, work the audience with nothing but a stool. You know what I'm saying? And it was so interesting because the night before, I'm a Kevin Hart fan, I saw Kevin, who's a rock comedy rock star, do a totally different show. It had pyrotechnics and this, and it just was like seeing two different, you know, people at the top of their career do something. But Dave, the way that he, you know, the things, you know, the hitting himself with the mic and just like the things that he sort of has become proprietary signature things of him, I felt like I'm in the middle of something special. And I don't know that concert. I mean, where he's at in his career right now. You know what I'm saying? It's wild.
Yeah. And so how do you think that affects, like, the idea of, like, you think that comedy, we were talking about the 10,000 hours and about the comedic voices. Is this about the self-censorship element of comedy right now?
Absolutely. And we don't have the scions that we used to have. You know what I'm saying? Art has always happened in salons. You know what I'm saying? There were writer salons and you know, artist salons, and, you know what I'm saying? And those guys would say, you know what, we're going to be cubists. And that became the period. Or these guys would say, we're going to write like this. And that became the period. And they had wealthy contributors that would sort of protect them so that they could still, like, you know, do their art. Now, the wealthy contributors are brands, you know what I'm saying, who have people and stockholders and things that they have to answer to. So you don't, if you're trying to come up and you have a voice, you know, and you still want to take care of yourself, you have to, like, watch what you're saying because your career could be over. You know what I'm saying? In an instant, and you're trying to formulate your thought and your voice, it could be over. And I feel like that hurts society.
Well, it's tricky, you know, also that, you know, that everything is so fragmented. So, you know, a big voice to how many people are they going to, is anyone going to know them? Like, I find that all the time. There's so much shit out there. I mean, you know, Chappelle has risen to this mythic level for a lot of different reasons. And Louis was sort of the king of comedy for a while, but then it sort of breaks apart. You know what I mean? Like, I've known Kevin for years, but, you know, I don't, you know, millions of people go to see him. But he doesn't seem to hold the same place as, like, Chappelle. Mm-hmm. He holds this other place. Like you said, he's a rock star. It's almost like bordering on motivational speaking.
No, seriously, it is. It's like going to a TED Talk with needle drops. In some aspect.
It is. So that's so weird to me that you were kind of like a – because, like, I saw Dave on the – when did I last see him? I was hanging out with him a few years ago at the Oddball Festival. And, yeah, he is sort of laid back, and he's always sort of thoughtful. And, you know, he is not that intimidating, I guess, once you get to know him. But you were kind of a nerdy writer guy, you would say?
100%. I mean, I was literally who I am. You know what I'm saying? Like, take away the – you know, like, I want to – you know, dress in sweatsuits, I've changed stuff. Like, I'm a kid who had asthma, who read, you know, a ton of comic books, who read, you know, Sidaris.
What comics?
All Marvel. I was a huge, all the whole X-Men thing. I, you know, there was a comic that I tried to get called Power Pack. It was about these kids that were like this family of kids who, like, an alien came down, he was dying, he gave them each one of his abilities, and they kind of like melded into like the mutant world of, yeah, of X-Men. When the X-Men were all the out branches were the best, with the movies that you wish Fox could have done, right? Because they were by far the better, way better than the Avengers.
So this is when you were a kid, you were sort of like a quiet kid, or you were like just holed up with comic books and Bob Newhart records?
I was a kid who was very close to his mom, who, you know, my brothers were in the streets, and my mom was determined to not let that happen with me. Uh-huh. My mom was working two jobs, and I remember she saved up and got me World Book Encyclopedias. And was like, read that. And I'm like, what? She was like, that, the whole thing. And like, so I started like reading the encyclopedia. And, you know, like, reading was like, you know, for me, a really, really big thing. I grew up in a neighborhood, you couldn't just go outside necessarily.
Was that bad?
Wasn't that it was that bad. It was, you know, it was fine. I would go outside, but you could also, the more time you spent outside, the more time you were going to become a part of the outside.
Become a part of the outside.
My brothers
I like that.
Had done that in their own way. So my mom was determined, and my sister too, was determined to sort of, you know, get me into other things.
And it worked.
It did work. I didn't think it would, but it did.
And were your brothers protective of it as well?
No. Nah, they were doing their thing. You know what I'm saying? Like they were dudes, and you know, then they got caught up with girls and drugs and jail and stuff like that. Not that they didn't love me, but they were in their life. My sister was really like my mom, and my mom was very, very supportive. So my grandmother, I was raised by like three generations of women.
And your father like split or was there?
No, he was there. He was definitely divorced, but like I knew my dad, and I would spend summers there, you know, things like that. But my dad also was on his own thing. You know what I'm saying? He was trying to find himself and, yeah. You know, just a guy, and you know, trying to really, you know, he wasn't empty or absent from my life, but he was not, you know, he and my mom had such a tumultuous sort of, yeah, my mom shot my dad in front of me, you know what I'm saying? Like, it had,
really?
Yeah, it had such a tumultuous sort of relationship that I made a choice when I was a kid, and the choice was undoubtedly my mom's side. And so whenever I'd have to be around my dad, I'm like, I'm not going to, you know, my dad broke my mom's jaw while my mom was pregnant with me. My mom had to drink, and it was the 70s, so she had to drink 70s protein shakes through a straw with her mouth wired. They didn't know if I was going to make it or not. You know what I'm saying? So you would hear these stories as you were coming up, like my mom has a little thing here, and you'd hear how it happened. And so I made a choice, and that choice was my mom. And my mom was very, very, very much so intent on all her kids going to college. Even my brothers who got in trouble went to USC, and my sister went to, like, she was like, this was – the whole point of the civil rights movement was that they fought so that we were not going to college was not a choice for us. And I think we were the first generation that was an obligation.
But how long, like how old were you when he was like out of the house?
Young. He got out the house when I was 5 or 6.
Uh-huh.
They were going through a divorce when my mom shot him. I think I was like 7 or 8. You know what I'm saying? When that happened.
Where'd she shoot him?
She shot him in the stomach.
Oh my God.
She will kill me for saying this. This is who my mom, black moms and Jewish moms are the same thing. I would say they both like believe in like disciplining through guilt. And like, and so my mom, I did an article at the New Yorker a few years ago, and I told the story when my dad broke into our house. Right. And my mom saw him like, you know, and she saw, heard the noise or whatever. And my mom had a gun, and she was, you know, saying, go home, Pat, go home. And my dad was like, what are you going to do, shoot me? And I saw my mom kind of close her eyes and turn her head.
Yeah.
And I tell the story that my mom pulled the trigger until I heard click. So she let off a lot of shots. She's like, I didn't shoot him 6 times. I only shot him 4. I only shot 4 times. I'm like, Mom, okay. I'm like, this is my story. I mean, you can't tell me the fucking bullet count for my drama. So, you know, but yeah, it was something.
And he survived.
He survived. Yeah, he survived. He big time survived. My dad was, I to this day believe that we were getting an autopsy, and Luckily, we ordered one so we could not go back. I think my dad died from corona. He died of acute respiratory failure a couple months ago, and it like came out of nowhere. But corona was not announced yet. You know what I'm saying? But now after it got announced, I'm like, oh my God, this was all the signs. Like clotting, you know, got on a ventilator, couldn't talk, you know what I'm saying, and hit him quickly, and he was just gone. And you know,
he was in LA?
He lived in Apple Valley. Yeah.
Well they say it was here a lot earlier than we think.
I think I'm waiting for the autopsy results now to get redone. I really would not be surprised at all if it was.
Just for your own peace of mind?
For my own peace of mind, because I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. We had renewed our relationship and actually found a really good place, and I got a chance to see him before he passed, but I didn't think he was going to pass because he went to the hospital and nothing was theoretically wrong with him, and then he died.
So where'd you go to college? You went to college in Atlanta.
Went to college at Clark Atlanta University.
And you were studying what?
Radio, television, film. I knew I wanted to do something. A lot of that came from, you know, knowing that I wanted to be a doctor at first, and then I took one semester of chemistry, and I've never felt stupider. Like I think I got like a 3% on a test, and I never came close to that.
So hard.
So hard. Like, so I was like, I just don't grasp this.
I couldn't either. I couldn't fucking grasp algebra. But chemistry was like, what the fuck?
They might as well have been talking another language. So I realized that it was probably not the path for me. And my best friend was Tyra Banks, and like she had blown up already when we were in high school. And
you knew her from that when you were a kid?
We knew for each other since we were babies. I felt like because she was such a big model at that time, and I was entering college, in a lot of ways, I felt like I wanted to go work with her or work for her. So that was part of my sort of like, I felt like she was so close to me, that would be a part of my world.
And it was.
And sometimes, yeah, we did top model together, yeah.
So you went for the full 4 years, you got a degree in show business. Mm-hmm.
Stayed in Atlanta for a quick second. Knew I wanted to get home. I had to get back to LA.
What were you doing in Atlanta? You stayed there for like a year after college or something?
Like maybe 6 months. I worked in music publishing, and I worked, you know, tried to work at CNN and like their like sports, you know, the sports division, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Like producing sports. And I just was like, why am I? I'm from LA. I'm from Hollywood. Why would I not go back home? So I got back home as quickly as I could. And, got a job working for this councilman named Nate Holden as his press deputy. And he was like always in trouble. but I thanked him for the job. But I was always talking to old ladies about their trash not getting picked up and, you know, wearing like Jose Banks suits to work and just like hating my life. And Tyra helped me get a internship or a public job at Roger Cowan was the name of the publicity of the firm at the time. And I was like my entree into show business. And I left there and got on as a PA, and this lady named Felicia Henderson, got on as a PA. Then I went to Keenan Ivory Wayne's show as like one of my friends was like in a writing program there. We kind of were writing stuff for Keenan, and then got on as—
Which show?
The Keenan Ivory Wayne late night comedy show. My friend—
Oh yeah.
Got on as a writer. Then I was helping him with stuff. And then I left there and I got on as a writer's assistant. This lady, Felicia Henderson, who's a big writer now, gave me my real break. And she helped me get in the Paramount Writers trainee program through this guy, Steve Stark. And just, you know, things started happening from, you know, here and there. And I went the PA route up, you know, and that's how I got.
Yeah. It's so funny. The Keenan, like, it's so weird. When I was a doorman at the Comedy Store in like the late 80s. And, you know, no one remembers Keenan for— he was a pretty good stand up.
Was he? I don't remember.
Yeah.
I remember Damon as a stand-up.
Damon was amazing. Like, I used to watch him all the time. He was another one that would just go out there.
Oh,
dude.
Yeah. He has that famous joke, you know, about once you get famous, like they come and ask you, now, Damon, now that you've made it in Hollywood, what do you think about the racism? And he said, he looked at the camera and goes, if it is racism, I didn't see none. He's like, and it was— it was such a joke ahead of its time. The notion of like them giving you, like, you know, buying your slavery back. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Right. He was great.
I believe that they are the most brilliant comedic family in history.
No kidding.
That's a hyperbolic statement, but that is what I believe. I believe that Keenan is a comedic genius. Damon is a genius. Marlon's a genius. Something, whatever it was in there. They grew up Jehovah's Witness too. And I think there's something about that. that is very interesting. I heard Jay-Z and Prince and just some other, I don't know if that's true, but I think there's something about a sort of oppressive, hard religious upbringing, you know what I'm saying?
Well, isn't the Jehovah's Witnesses where you can't really dance and shit?
Can't have birthdays, no Christmas. You can go to dances within. You're not supposed to be, they call it worldly. You're not supposed to be worldly. You're not supposed to be of the world. You're supposed to keep within your, you know, your group because, you know, worldly things will infect you. And, you know, so like, you know, the idea of sort of socializing is in terms of what the world is shunned upon. And all
right.
Kid, all you want to do is like do what you're not supposed to do. So I think people who came out of that, Michael Jackson, like it causes this sort of like explosion once you hit society because you have so much inside of you. You know, so that's my
that makes sense
philosophy on it.
But you didn't grow up with that strict situation.
I did not. My mom, and because my mom and dad were both separate things, we didn't have to go to either. The kids didn't have to choose. You know what I'm saying? My mom went to the hall, and sometime we'll go with her. My dad would go to the mosque, and sometimes, you know, we participate in that.
So so you do the PA route, but what, how do you come up? Because did you create America's Next Top Model with Tyra?
Yeah. Tyra and I were developing a couple movies at the time, and they were getting in development hell, and reality was kind of at its like sort of like nascent sort of birthplace. And we were like, I was like, you know what? You're a big model. We should do something with what you do other than us trying to sort of like make a star. I was like, let's. And so we started really kind of the original thing we titled for Top Model was going to be like Brains, Beauty and Brawn. Like we were going to sort of like have them models because we were kind of copying off a Survivor, like on an island who are pretty, but they also have to use like strength and their smarts to like get out of different situations. And that sort of went away and we started talking about like, which should be the, you know, Sarah started telling me that there actually is a technique to modeling and there's secret things. I had never heard this. And I was like, this is sort of like how Making the Band is, how there's a part of something. And so we ended up getting Ken Mock, who was one of the creators of Making the Band. And he was the guy who sort of like took and helped shape Top Model into a show.
And that was, it was a huge show. It was a kind of like, it set some sort of precedent. It was, you know, because that model of show became applied to any number of shows.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and it was very derivative, and everybody but me got rich off of that show. I got enough money to say no to some things. You know what I'm saying? For me, I might as well have been rich, but you know, they got rich, rich. I don't fuck with Ken Mock to this day because I feel like he fucked me. You know what I'm saying? Out of that show.
Yeah, how'd you get fucked?
I was very green. You know what I'm saying? But I you know, obviously I had, you know, I had taste, and that's something I think that, you know, Rashida says, Rashida Jones says, her taste is her talent. And I kind of feel like I'm just going to steal that. And so that's sort of my talent. I had good taste and I knew it was hot or not. And so I knew when things weren't right. And Ken, the very first episode had turned the first episode into the network without showing me or Tyra. And I lost my shit. And I you know, cause I'm at that time I'm fresh. I'm young. I'm like not that long from being in the streets. You know what I'm saying? I came in, this little Asian dude, and I was ready to beat his ass. And I told him in his office, I was like, I'm gonna fuck you up. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I handled it completely wrong, but
no,
I know completely wrong, but it was, I felt so, you know, assaulted by it. And like, I basically quit. You know what I'm saying? I basically was like, I don't want to be a part.
Right.
And I took a buyout and, you know what I'm saying? I let them sort of strong arm me into what I, you know, what I should have been. I should have gotten a lot more from it, but I, you know, it was the most amazing thing. It started my career. You know what I'm saying? It gave me the power to say no in a way that I can't, you know what I'm saying? Really.
Yeah. So how did you settle on, you know, creating comedy after that? It seems like a big jump.
I always wanted to do comedy. You know, I got into my first real, you know, job was on a drama. I wrote a drama for 4 seasons, this drama with this lady, Felicia Henderson. This drama, Soul Food.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So
that was, you were just in the room? You were in the writer's room?
I was in the writer's room. I was between there and Canada. They taped it in Canada, so I'd go up there for taping.
So that was the first time in a writer's room for a job?
Well, I kind of was in the writer's room with writers a little bit, you know, around the Kenan writers, but not really.
Right.
It really was... that was my first, like, in a writer's room paid. I had done a writer's room on BET, but that was the first big writer's room show that I had done.
What's the BET writer's room?
It was, I worked for on a show called Live from LA. It was this comedian, Michael Collier.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember him.
And he had a show, and it was a lot of funny writers on there, actually.
Michael Collier, he used to be a street performer, right?
A street performer at Venice Beach.
In Venice Beach, yeah. I remember him. Yeah, what happened to that guy?
I don't know. I love him, though. He came and did Blackish, and he did such a good job.
Oh, that's nice.
And he was so funny, really good guy.
So now the writer's room experience, I mean, so you really kind of pulled it together all the way from PA, and then but you weren't a writer's assistant at Kenan Show. You were just a PA.
I was a PA. And then,
so that's where you learned it.
We had gotten, Lady Shauna Gar was giving us a writer's job, and the show got canceled right as before our first writer's job. You know, we got it, and and it went away as the show was getting.
Who? You and who?
My partner at the time was this guy, Faisant Walker.
Uh-huh.
And it was you guys actually, Ian Edwards was one of the writers on that show. And I think Ian is one of the funniest dudes. And there was Vernon Chapman was on that show. But some of the funniest human beings.
You know, which show is this?
This was the Keenan Ivory Wayans show.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Vernon's like a real, he's out there, dude. He's a genius.
He had a pitch that they still talk about now. It was, he pitched a sketch called Too Many Niggas on Stage.
Yeah.
And it was like a Wu-Tang-esque group. And like a guy came out and he was like, yo, God, he's like, I got a new God. I got God. And it's like, and all of a sudden, like it's 100 people on stage and the stage collapses. And you hear as like, it's like a mess of everything. And you just hear from under the rubble, man, we got too many niggas on stage. And it was, I knew when Vernon went to go write for Chris Rock, you could hear the jokes. You could hear his voice. You know what I'm saying? And you could hear this other guy, Michael Anthony Snowden, just a fucking brilliant guy. He co-wrote Scary Movie and White Chicks or some of those other things, whatever. But,
the Wayans Show.
Yeah, but like brilliant people. And you could hear, that was my first time, like you started being like I can hear a Marc Maron joke. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
My partner, Jonathan Groff, came and did your show. And
John Groff?
Yeah, he was my partner on Blackish.
John Groff and I started together in Boston doing stand-up. I got him his first writing job.
Oh, wow. He's a funny motherfucker, dude.
He I was hosting Short Attention Span Theater on Comedy Central, and he was a comic, but, like, he was moving into writing. But we did open mics together in Boston in the fucking 80s, dude.
Oh, wow.
So I'd known him a long time, and they didn't want to hire a writer at this dumb little clip show I did. And I made them I pulled in John, and that was his first job writing. And then he went on to Conan, and that was history.
He's a monster in the writer's room. Seriously.
Really?
He he's a Jeopardy grand champion and
yeah,
it's just super funny. You know, guy that like bits will come out of the, you're not even thinking about stuff and he'll just do it.
I forgot that he was there. So you created that together?
No, I created it. I created it, but
how'd you meet him?
So when I was creating it, the person they brought on to help me through the pilot was Larry Wilmore, who huge fan of. Larry and I parted before the show started, or right before the show came on, because Larry got the nightly show or whatever, and so I knew I was going to need going into it. I knew before the show even got picked up that Larry was going to have his show, so I knew I was going to need an experienced person to do this with. And we brought in Jonathan Groff. So he was there with me from the beginning. And although he didn't create the show with me, he is by in every aspect my partner on that show. Like he was amazing. You know, he, for a white guy from, you know, New Hampshire or Boston, wherever he's from, to come in to let a guy who had never run a show before do something different, because that show hadn't really quite been done like that before. And I just was telling stories about my family, and let me sort of like really run a show, but at the same time told me what I didn't know and dealt with the network and dealt with editing. Anyone else, the ego that would have been, they would have possibly had, would have not let my voice come out. But he really, really, really fostered my voice in a way. And he did the same thing with the kid who created David Kass, who created Happy Endings. You know what I'm saying? He was there's a few of those guys, Ira Ungerlinger, there's a few of those guys who in town, they do something really special. And they know how to come in and work with writers and let their voice come out, but at the same time, not let their ego get in the way so that the show doesn't suffer. And he's one of those guys, and he's, you know, paid well for it.
But so wait, so what was the jump to, so when you created Black-ish, what was the inspiration, man? Like, you were just, it's time for a black show?
I sold a ton of pilots. I sold 19 pilots, and, you know, they had gone to various levels, but never went all the way. And mm-hmm. I was in those pilots. I think I was trying to, like, do the family people wanted to see. Sometime I'd write a show and then it'd be, I'd turn the characters white. You know what I'm saying? Or I'd do sort of like the, you know, the Malik and Saul, like a black guy and a Jewish guy who live next door. You know, I was trying to like find some hook. And I felt like I really started like thinking the people who I loved and the people that I sort of like really wanted to emulate, the thing that they did time and time again was they told their story. And so I was like, you know, I finally was like, fuck it. You know, I had so many friends. My wife's a doctor. You know, I had these kids who, you know, you're taught to give your kids more than you have. But yeah. Doing that, what do they lose? You know what I'm saying? What do you lose out on? And I had these kids who were black kids, but didn't look like it, the black kids that I remember in terms of the things that they wanted, the things that they did, their friends. And I started talking to so many of my friends, and that was their experience too, whether they were black or white. And so that was sort of the conceit of the show, is that our people our age having kids, we were kind of started like being the dinosaurs.
Right.
Thing. And I was trying to like hold on to like the blackness in my kids, but at the same time, I wanted them to sort of have the privileges of little white kids. And so yeah. That was sort of the conceit of like what Black-ish was about. And, you know, when I got a chance to do it, it was, you know, Lawrence Fishburne is why that show got picked up. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was just uh-huh. a big star to be doing comedy and like such a big jump.
He's so good in it.
He's beyond good. And Anthony Anderson and Tracy Ross are why it stayed on. You know what I'm saying? Because they're all, you know, but like, we all, you know, kind of came together and we were in this little siloed off pod. Will Moore, Groff, me, you know, the guys. And it just was like we did something and you could kind of feel, we didn't know if it was going to work or not, but you kind of felt like whether it worked or not, it was, you felt good about it and you felt like it was different.
In your mind, like sort of like, what do you think, how was it part of the evolution of that, of a black family show? Like what, how was it different in your mind?
So I think Cosby for me, you know, was amazing. You know what I'm saying? I think that it changed society. You know, it was the first time my white friends wanted the same dad that I wanted. You know what I'm saying? I was like, oh, you want to be your dad too? I want to be my dad too. Like, you know, in it, but Cosby was very, he was very political in that he made a point. The Cosby Show, they could have been white. You know what I'm saying? You could take those characters and tell the same, basically the same stories.
Right.
And he did that purposely. You know, he did not talk about race. And I made a point with Black-ish that it was absolutely about a black family, you know, and like it was about their experiences. And so I think that was the evolution. And at the same time, it was, whereas the Cosbys never really seemed conscious of their socioeconomic status. You know what I'm saying? That was a multi-million-dollar brownstone. And they were, you know, obviously doing really well. They never really seemed too conscious of their socioeconomic status. That show, Black-ish was very conscious of like, they have made it, you know what I'm saying? Or, you know, they have, you know, they're at the, you know, and really in the middle class pool in a real big way,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
You know, subsequently it ended up, I think one of the things that kept that show on and keeps it going is for a long time, the group that watched it the most was the highest per income family, highest per income groups of any show on television watched that show. I don't know
Cosby.
Why. No, Black-ish.
Oh, okay, good.
I think that it was the sort of aspirational wish fulfillment part of it, you know what I'm saying? But like the people who watched it, there were a lot of, for advertisers who wanted to come and sell expensive stuff, that was a good place for them. And so I think that it got great ratings at first, and then Empire came and took all our African-American viewers away because it was opposite us. But, you know, got you know, really decent ratings and still gets decent ratings, but it was I think the voice of that show ended up being what actually made it special.
Right. For sure. And did you find that, like, cause I know that, you know, whatever your relationships were with your family, that, you know, that this is a milder version of you and your father.
Oh, 100%. That was the love letter to my dad.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That was, you know, my dad, you know, was not that version of what Pops is, but he had some of those things.
Yeah.
We saw Pops out. You know, I was just having this conversation. It's so interesting.
You left out the jaw breaking.
I left out the jawbreaking and the him get. I did not leave out that she shot him though. I did not leave in Blackish. You know, the mom has shot the dad. Uh-huh. You know, there's a great thing I like. You know, Honeymooner is one of my favorite shows. Ralph Graham did. You know what I'm saying? Like,
sure.
But the notion of what the difference between black characters and white characters, like, here was a character that wore a wife beater that told his wife, you know, say one more fucking word, I'm gonna punch you in your fucking mouth. And that was like a beloved, you know, statement. You know what I'm saying? Like,
to the moon.
To the moon. I'm gonna fucking punch you in your. And, but the notion,
you knew he'd never do it.
You knew he'd never do it, but the idea of a, I think that was the notion of what Cosby understood, that he could never at that time be a black character. He had to be perfect. It's
right.
it was Barack and the Romney debates. You know what I'm saying? Where you knew Barack could have sliced him to shreds during that debate, but you have to meter yourself. And that was Cosby metering himself. For me, Blackish was a little bit more stepping, not quite pow to the moon, but you had, you know, Anthony is blustery, you know what I'm saying? Lawrence was a little bit, you know, not great as a grandfather, you know what I'm saying? So it was a stepping out a little bit. And I kind of think what I wanted to do when I did this show at Netflix was take that next step, you know what I'm saying? And say that we could not have to worry about, not just not worry about being perfect, be completely fucked up, you know what I'm saying? Be completely fucked up and be completely flawed, you know, but that be a version of what the black experience is, because we're not monolithic. You know what I'm saying? We're not, you know, there's a version of it that lives in the Cabrini-Green's projects where Good Times is. There's a version that lives in that brownstone with Cosby. There's a version that lives in Studio City with Blackish. There's a version that lives, you know, with Bernie Mac. And there's, you know, there we don't have to keep telling the same version of a story.
That's right. So that's more than four stories. That's good.
But it's still a family story. But I'm trying to not be a part of that four story version.
I think what's unique about you right now is in talking to you, but in watching the new show, is your weird self consciousness. So like, because that's the primary difference is, you know, there's the swagger necessary to maintain a type of lifestyle that you judge yourself against as being, you know, what kind of like slightly irresponsible rich black person should be.
Yes.
Like your awareness of it, and you're judging yourself, putting yourself in between those guys that you know, and in between this Jewish kid and also Hollywood, or who was the guy that made who was the writer? Was it
Steve Levitan?
Yeah, Levitan. Like you are, that's part of you in your head. And it always
Absolutely.
Has been part of you.
Like, you know, it's interesting because that story is a real, the conceit of that story is based on a thing with Jeffrey Katzenberg. I went to, the stupidest thing I did when I got any money is I bought a Ferrari. You know what I'm saying? I did it. It has like 400 miles and I never drive it, but I did it. And I was kind of embarrassed to drive it. And one night I got tickets, floor seats to the Lakers game. And I was like, I asked my daughter, I was like, hey, you want to go to the game? And she was like, sure, I'll go to the game. I was like, let's take the Ferrari. I was like, you've never even been in it, right? She was like, no. So we had a daddy-daughter night. We went out. We're sitting on the floor. And who walks up to me halftime? It's like fucking Jeffrey Katzenberg. And I look up. I'm like, hey, Jeffrey Katzenberg. And he's like, hey, man. He's like, I just want to tell you I'm a big fan. I'm like, the fuck are you talking about, Jeffrey Katzenberg? I'm looking for fucking Ashton Kutcher to come out, run out. I'm like, what's happening right now? And he's like, you know, look, man, I really love your voice. He's like, would you ever want to have breakfast? I'm like, sure, Jeffrey Katzenberg. I'd love to have breakfast one day. So I give him, we exchange numbers. It's, you know, we go back to the game. It's an overtime game. Me and my daughter have a great time. We get home late, 11:30. I'm like, you know, getting out of the shower. Jeffrey Katzenberg texts me. He's like, hey, bud, would you want to have breakfast somewhere? I'm like, oh, shit, he followed up. And I'm like, yeah, Jeffrey Katzenberg, I'll have breakfast with you. So I'm like, you know, rushing out. He wants to go to John and Benny's in L.A. I live in the Valley. I'm like, I got to get over there. I'm running. It's late. I know there's going to be traffic. And I run out the house and I realize where I parked the car. Usually I park in the garage. It was blocking all the other cars and I was already late. And I was like, fuck, I'm going to have to take this car. I was like, you know what? I'll park it up the street. So I go to park it up the street. Of course, there's no parking spaces. Of course, I'm about to run late. So I'm like, fuck it. I'll just park it. I'll run in. As I get out the car, who's in the fucking Prius ahead of me? Fucking Jeffrey Katzenberg. And he gets out and he looks and he turns around. He's like, hey, man. Nice car. Nice for you. Nice car. Hey there. He's kind of comes up to the side and he opens up the passenger. He's like, what year is this? I'm like, I don't know. You're just one of them. Man. Just, I All I was hearing in my head is, hey, black guy spending all his money on a car, I could buy Ferrari. And I just was like, I wanted to burn the car. I wanted to take it and burn it in the middle of fucking. I was so bothered that during the breakfast, I'm not even listening to anything he's saying. I'm just Googling, does Jeffrey Katzenberg have jet? I'm like, I want to see, like, does he spend his money irresponsibly too? Like, I'm not listening to shit he says. And I'm mad at myself because I'm like, honestly, in terms of a Ford, I could afford this car. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't like an expense that I was, but I felt stupid having it. I felt even stupider that this billionaire is in a Prius. You know what I'm saying? And right. I felt that's the duality that starts the conceit of the show that lasts, basically, is that I'm constantly fighting this sort of like damned if I do, damned if I don't feeling.
Yeah, has that always been with you? That, you know, because you do seem a little thoughtful in the sense of like, you're not cocky. I mean, it sounds like, you have your moments where you get pissed off, but it's not like you do something where totally shameless without recognizing what you're doing.
Yes, I think I forced myself to do it. Like, there's been moments when I'm sitting at like a fucking parent teacher conference and I catch a glimpse of myself in like the mirror and I'm like, this teacher is not taking me seriously. Like, I have I have sagging jeans on, a hoodie with $200,000 worth of chain sticking out of it. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, I'm like, this person is not taking me serious. And I realize that I'm supposed to be a parent here. And then I have to always like, but fuck that. This is who I'm always living that back and forth moment.
But that just tells me that, there's some part of you that doesn't take it serious. That you're like, what am I doing?
I absolutely know. I'm desperately trying not to be the old guy who's trying to be hip. You know what I'm saying? It's right at that point though. I'm right there.
It's hard to know how to dress as an old guy.
It is.
Because like there just seems to be like either you try and hang on or you're just wearing clothes and no one even fucking notices.
Exactly. Exactly. And you wanna and the notion of even trying sometime, you do better to not try, because if you try and fail, then you've actually really failed. Yeah. But if you don't try and you fail, like I wasn't trying, I don't care. So trying sometimes makes it a little bit hard, so you're a little bit more conscious of it. So I'm very conscious of everything with myself. You know what I'm saying? I remember seventh grade, my face broke out horribly, right? When you start to like girls, right when you're, you know what I'm saying? And, it made me, I think that more than anything, along with stuff, made me sort of funny, because I went and sat in the back of the class. I would sit in the back of the class and I would just watch every single person that walked in. I'd look at them every day from head to toe. And I'd wait for someone to say, I was a shy kid. And I'd wait for someone to say, try to bag on me. And they'd say a bag. And I would say something back so quick that was so fucking sharp and so painful that like I would just crush them. And they'd be like, how did he think about that? So, and I'm like, oh, I've been thinking of sitting on this for 3.5 months. I've been waiting for you. I was so prepared and ready that like I was like loved by fear.
Yeah. But that's like those are good comic chops to have.
Yeah.
The sort of the preemptive, insult.
Yes. Yes. If I was doing comedy now, I would look in the audience before I got up and I would just fucking just look at like who was a little boisterous and I would just wait. I would have 10 jokes ready.
Oh, yeah.
For everybody before I got up.
You got to have that skill. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of how I looked at all audiences for probably the first decade of doing comedy. Like they don't like, like I would go into it assuming they didn't like me and that there was going to be a problem.
And you were ready.
I was ready. And if there wasn't a problem, I'd make one.
It was like a fucking stand your ground open carry mic room.
That's right. It was just sort of like, I would focus in on the one fucker that had a sour face and I just ruined the entire show to shit on that guy.
I saw Ian Edwards destroy a woman. I mean, like, literally made, I'm sure she went home and rethought her life and she deserved every point moment of it. But it's like, I don't know if audiences understand that. Like sometime if a comic, a real comic, is having a bad night, don't give him a good night. Don't turn it into a good night. You know what I'm saying? Like, let him go down in flames, because that is one thing that most comics can do. You say something and you can turn their night around.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it was like, it really became this weird thing. The evolution of my interaction with crowds was, most of the time, you know, what other people are thinking is something you're making up. When you see somebody and you make assumptions, you have no fucking idea what they're thinking, and they're not even thinking about you most of the time.
Right.
So it's like, why base your entire attitude on this idea that you're projecting onto them? Like, I talked to this British comic, Stuart Lee. He said, like, if someone doesn't like me, I now have to, like, and this is a guy that quit the business because he couldn't stand the stupidity of the audiences. But now, like, he comes back and he's got this new attitude where he sees somebody that clearly doesn't understand him or doesn't like him and doesn't think he's funny. And his thought is like, yeah, this was not a bad choice for you this night.
You made a wrong decision.
Right, and right. He has empathy, sort of like, yeah, this isn't going to be great for you. And you know. So, all right. Well, all these other shows are going good, or like, are you done, or how many issues are we gonna?
We might do one more. There's three of them now. We might do one more that I'm excited about. Those guys are my family, and it has been the gift that has not stopped giving for me. You know, it is. I have a special place in my heart for network television, because you get to really reach families in a different kind of way.
Sure.
You know, and the rules that are placed upon you actually make your show better in some aspects. It makes it wider. You know, I shouldn't say better. It makes it wider. And you learn to write for a wide audience. I was scared as fuck with this Netflix show. And I'm still, you know, it's interesting. I took a ton of bad press. You know what I'm saying? But it's also the most talked about thing I've ever done. You know what I'm saying? It is very polarizing. And it's like people, I literally look and like people love it or they hate it. You know, I woke up Sunday to like a left hook from the Atlantic, you know, like just taking a swing at the show. And
what was the angle?
Basically, it was someone who felt that I, you know, had some clandestine sort of fucking message in the show that wasn't up to what she felt Black culture should be. And I'm just like, I want to have an open, this is where I want to like be an old West gunslinger.
Yeah.
I'm open to debating every one of these people, because I feel like the notion of people defining what is Black or what's Black enough or what's not Black enough or what's too Black or whatever is like, who the fuck are you? You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm telling my personal experience. You can't tell me what, you don't want to watch it, don't watch it. You know what I'm saying? And
but talk haven't about those- it. Discussions been going on since, you know, the Black middle class was invented.
Yeah, but I think that right now there is a self-appointed vanguard, which I like to call the woke media. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you know, it goes along with white critics too. This fucking guy, you know, but I understand more when, you know, this fucking reviewer at fucking Variety, I don't know what this guy's name is, but I'm writing it down. Like, you could have sworn I like slept with his girlfriend or something. Like, it was and like the embargo on when you could review the show came up. Say it stops at like 12 a.m. on Thursday, you can start. He posted his like 12:03, so it set the
furious,
stage, furious, just personally angry at me, personally angry at me, furious. Like, I mean, like if you read, you should read the review. It's like, man. And so he set the stage for people sort of to start taking shots, you know. But at the same time, it was called the funniest show of the year by like the Chicago Sun Times or something, like, you know, and you know, people at the Deadline loved it, and people at this loved it, and people at this hated it. But the Atlantic took a shot, you know, in their sort of, you know, academic way, and I appreciate it. Although I didn't agree with it, I appreciate that everyone should have their opinion. I think that's important. I wish that I could say I didn't read these and I didn't care, but I do fucking care. You know,
sometimes
what I'm saying?
If somebody's smart, you know, you can, it's easier to take in a sense, because you're like, all right, well, I get the argument. This isn't just an
attack.
Even if
I don't agree. Yes. Even if I don't agree, I get the argument.
Right.
Right. And so even if I feel like you totally missed it, which I think this person did, I get you at least formed an opinion that was based on, gave some context to your opinion.
Isn't there an element of it that really is addressing, you know, that conflict of like how we're supposed to live and who gets to decide that?
I absolutely. And I think that actually even enticed the media more to want to talk about the show, because there was that sort of almost indictment, you know what I'm saying, of critics. And I think that this article actually was saying that the indictment had the presumption of that there were no black critics. And I didn't say that, you know what I'm saying, but that was what this person, you know, extracted from it. With that being said, you know, I, you know, close my laptop, my stomach is hurting, and I get the nicest text from Malcolm Gladwell, who I'm not friends with or whatever, who got my number for some, and says that he enjoyed the show. And it was so gratifying. I hope he's okay with me saying that, but it was so gratifying because I am like a disciple of Malcolm Gladwell. I love how he takes things that seem random and nothing, and from an economist's point of view, puts them in a way that still, you know, gives some order to seeing the things that seem like they didn't have order before. So, you know, it
like
was
like a comic.
Like a comic, seriously. Yeah. Pulls and finds the things that are observational, you know what I'm saying, and actually puts them in a way that you're like, oh, I never thought about it like that.
Right.
You know, yeah. So you know, it's very polarizing, it's very divisive. I think that if I'm gonna be honest, if I had to do it all over again, I probably would do that again. You know, not try to be polarizing on purpose, but I would want to say something that probably, if you say anything that's ever worth being said, it's going to be if everybody agrees with what you said, you're probably wrong. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. If you, or else you're spineless. I used to do a joke about if you don't have at least one guy out there saying this about you, that guy's a fucking asshole. you haven't really made an impact.
That's right. Seriously. Seriously. So, you know, it is, Netflix is a really big platform and you don't realize how big it is.
Until you get lost.
Seriously. And that was a really big part of, like, for me coming from ABC, where you knew you had that score in the morning after your show, you knew you had a score and you knew that they were going to promote you because you were on their airway. So you knew you were going to get commercials. You knew you had a market. The idea that Netflix, I think, is going to do 400 series this year, you know what I'm saying? And so the idea of standing out in that crowd, you know what I'm saying, was unbelievably important to me. You know, I wanted to make sure that it was noisy. You know, and, you know, Andy and Jane and Ted and Cindy and Channing and the team over there in Ghazal, like, you know, the comedy team over there, like, really gave me an opportunity because it was not without a fight. Like, they were very scared of me playing the role. You know,
really?
I think,
yeah, oh, I think, yeah, I think you're the, like, the best thing about the show.
Oh my God. I'm a horrible actor, but
hilarious,
but it works in some aspects at certain times enough for that show. And it makes it a little bit noisier. I think Larry playing himself in Curb makes it noisier. And if he had went and had an actor, it would just been another Seinfeld. And if I had an actor, it would have just been exactly another Black-ish.
Yeah, but you're funny.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks. I do not see myself in that aspect. I think that I'm funny on the page. I think that I have a sense of humor. The thing that I got, and it's, I really give so much credit to Rashida Jones.
Yeah.
Because she, you know, she's a talented, gifted comedic actress, and she gave me support in a way that let me sort of be myself. And that's the hardest thing. It was what you did in your show. Like, you know, it was you, her, Marin. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's what you're, whether, and I was able to say whether it worked or not, right, at least I had to do it the way that I felt like I was, it was as close to my version of that hyperbole of a character.
Yeah. I think it's hilarious. And what was your, like, like you say, when your old man died, that you guys had some sort of, you guys were okay with each other. So he was able to kind of see your success and be part of it, as was your mother.
Yeah, they really were. It's been very, it's very difficult at times. I think my dad handled it better than my mom because he's a guy.
Yeah,
my mom is, you know, it's, you know, she's, you know, she will say, you know, why didn't you tell me about, you know, I saw in the paper that you did this, and I'm like, Mom, you don't care about that. Why do you? I'm saying, like, but I think she wants to know that, she so she can tell her friends,
right.
I bought my mom, helped my mom, you know, We got my mom a car, helped her get her, we'd get her house. And she was, my mom does fine, you know what I'm saying? But she wanted to say, my son did this.
Right.
It was very important for her to say that, you know what I'm saying? And I think that, you know, it's hard. I think it's been harder on my family because that's the thing, I think, just with Black culture in particular. I think like Tyler Perry, as an example, you know, my mom and, you know, I like Tyler. I very much so like some of the things he does. Everything he does is not my cup of tea. But I think that my mom and aunts and, you know, some of my cousins, like, they love Tyler. Like, they go and they were watching him, his plays on VHS before it came out. And they would go first day, first weekend, his movies are number one. And they really, from their heart, not because he's Black, they liked his movies. And because the, you know, the Hollywood or whatever, the masses may say it's not elevated comedy or not elevated art. What the fuck? That means that these people who say they like it, their opinion is wrong. And so I'm getting back to the point of what I'm getting at is that I think it's unfair in a little bit because for Tyler, he has to carry the weight of so much of the culture. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because there's so few of us. You know what I'm saying? There's so few of us that, like, you know, Adam Sandler, who I think is amazing, you know what I'm saying? But like Adam Sandler puts out fucking Jack and Jill. It's not the end of white culture. You know what I'm saying? He doesn't destroy white culture because he puts out, you know, some fucking, you know, movie that people might say that's a shitty Adam Sandler movie that makes a ton of money so he can keep doing it. But it's not the end of white culture. But we put, there's so few of us out that when we do something, it is put under the scrutiny of you have the whole entire culture. And I think so, that happens with my family too, because there's so few of us that get to, like, you know, be successful as a writer. I think, you know, in a times of a comedy writer, like Black comedy writer, like I'm probably one of the bigger Black comedy writers, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
So it's a very unique thing. And as my mom is not, that's not something that her, she can say that people are used to seeing.
Yeah.
And so it puts a lot of pressure on that first generation success, first generation, you know.
Right. And also thing. Then there's the element too, that you depending on, like, I remember when my grandmother got all her friends together to see my 1995 HBO half hour.
Yes,
and within, within the first minute, I say fuck like 90 times. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, I call her up. I'm like, what did you think? She's like, why did you have to be so filthy? Like, but you're also up against this idea that, you know, you're doing your thing on Netflix and there's a possibility that your mother's generation is like, why can't you be more like Tyler Perry?
Yes. No, my mom, absolutely. When I quit BET, I was working on a show called The Game on BET, and I quit BET to go do my pilot on ABC. And my mom was like, so you're leaving BET, huh? You know, those people, they really supported you over there. You know, I was like, yeah, my mom went to ABC. I know, but you know, it's so interesting. I, you know, for her, she's like, that's her people. You know what I'm saying? My mom and I, those are my people too, but I understand the idea from a career standpoint. That was a jump and a leap that lets me now go back to BET if I choose to. Right. You know what I'm saying? But the idea of like being able to say to little kids to look up and want to be a writer, that there is a writer who made it in mainstream.
Right.
And they decided to go back to BET and, you know, and helps give BET help. I can help rise that, you know, help that boat rise. But I think that, you know, it's so scary for us sometimes because there's so few of us to make those leaps.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, you know, because there's a, you know, the different version of that is people who actually, you know, are held back or hold themselves back, you know, because the culture pressures them to do it.
Yeah.
You know, to get out of that mental head, you know.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
It's like Chris Rock joke, but can you kick my ass? You know, like the notion of like, you know, it's fuck all that smarty arty shit. You know what I'm saying? But like the idea of it, you know, it's a constant, it's the duality, the idea of we're constantly sort of speaking two languages. You know what I'm saying? As being African-American and being Black in America, you are speaking the language of your culture, which is now being fragmented into many different languages. And you're speaking the language of the mainstream. And so I think that it's even becoming harder for Black culture because now Black culture is not, it used to be sort of a singular thing.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing the Black culture is it's Donald Glover on Atlanta. You know what I'm saying? It's Gerard Carmichael. It's Tyler Perry. You know, it's Cardi B. And so we're kind of like, we're at that sort of infighting stage. But I think that we will come out of this better. I do. But I think that we are at that stage.
One of my favorite Pryor lines is when he goes back home after he first gets successful. And the guy in the pool hall says, he's just doing the same shit you did around here. Give me And he goes, he says, give me a dollar.
It is so fucking real. That shit is so real. But that, the specificity of Richard saying that,
yeah,
so many people, there's a version that you understand of that.
Yeah.
You
know what I'm saying? Sure. Exactly. Oh, yeah, of course.
Whenever you level up, there's always somebody's like, whatever. You know what I'm saying? The idea of that is so universal. But speaking about it from my culture, you know what I'm saying? We have a specific, you know, I put a tweet out and I erased it so quickly. I was like, niggas are such haters nowadays. It's not even fun being rich anymore. You know, like quietly comfortable is the new rich. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
Let me take this down because this will ruin me. But the notion of, I understand, you know, that there, you know, there's so few of us, you know what I'm saying, making these things that we do, as much as we may not want it, there is a responsibility that we do represent the whole culture each time we step out. And I can't like get so mad that I respond back in a, you know, a way that seems like I'm not being open to, you know, to my community, because I do understand that I do owe them. And I do know that they have, you know, put me in position in a way. And although I don't agree with everything, I do owe them.
Yeah. And also, but you're also honoring that part of you that that respects comedy that that does that, to be unleashed a little bit and then to see what happens, to be provocative.
Absolutely. That's why when I got a chance to do this, when I got a chance to do your show, when I did the whatever shows on NPR with the woman's never in the room, Terry Gross.
Oh yeah, Terry. Yeah, yeah.
I did Terry Gross. When I got a humanity, there's moments that I feel like as a comedian, as a comic writer, I'm like, they matter. You know what I'm saying? And like, this is what I'm, and I feel like, you know, my big thing now is to really make sure that I let everyone know how much my image awards matter. You know what I'm saying? And let everyone else know how much they matter to them too. And like that we need to start, you know, heralding ourselves more, you know what I'm saying? And looking for such outside, such outside applause.
Yeah.
They're inside too.
Well, thanks for talking to me, man.
Thank you, man. This has been an honor.
Oh, I appreciate it. And it was really a good conversation, man.
I appreciate it, man. I hope I see you in traffic soon.
Yeah, we should. We should hang out. Yeah.
I love that.
At some point when we get through the plague.
Did you see the fucking Pentagon put out like confirmed UFO footage?
Oh, come on. When was this?
It's like 2 days ago on CNN. I look it up and I'm like, Pentagon, you don't think you could have waited for this?
Yeah.
You don't think why we have enough on our plates right now?
Tell them to deliver a fucking cure to this shit.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Mark.
That was me and Kenya Barris. Black AF, Black as Fuck, is now streaming on Netflix. It was good to talk to him, as I recall. But my heart was in a different place before it was crushed. Bleak. Sad. How about just sad? I'm a grown-ass man. All right? I've been playing some guitar. I've been just pounding at it. I've got to... It's hard to connect. The feelings that are happening inside of me with things that are coming out of me. Out of my mouth, out of my hands. But here.
Boomer lives.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.